Calling all small firm architects. It's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast. It's a community where dreams meet action.
There is a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success. My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. Rebecca McWilliams, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Thank you so much, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you here. Rebecca is a licensed architect and an attorney with deep experience in both fields. Her areas of expertise includes small business risk management, insurance, technology, and contracts. She is a partner in Policyholder Pros LLC, LLP, representing insurance policyholders in negotiating homeowner claims in litigation against their insurance companies. As a New Hampshire legislator, Rebecca serves on the House Science, Technology, and Energy Committee. In 2019, she drafted and passed legislation to update the state building and energy code from following the 2009 to the 2015 International Building Code. So you have your hands in everything. And on top of that, three kids living on their family farm in Concord, New Hampshire. And from what I've gathered, doing a little research, it's a real working farm. So you're an architect, you're an attorney, you're a mom, you're a legislator, you're a farmer, and probably lots of other things from what I'm gathering here.
Mark, I'm living the dream.
It is awesome. And you're an active member over at the Entree Architect Community, our private Facebook group for small firm architects, and you're an active member there and contributing all the time. So I appreciate you for doing that. We connected because of a post over at the Entree Architect Community Facebook group about somebody had an issue with a client, and project sort of went south and they didn't really know what to do. And so they went to the group, which is exactly what that group is for. It's a private group. It's only architects. So we can have whatever conversations we want there. That was one of those days where that architect needed some help and some guidance about what do I do here? I have some legal issues, I have some contractual issues, I have some project issues. And Rebecca jumped in and shared some thoughts and some advice. And then we connected afterward and said, hey, we should do a podcast about this. And so I would love to have that conversation about what do you do when your project goes south. But before we do that, I want to learn more about you. I want you to dive a little bit deeper into your origin story. How and why did you become an architect and then an attorney? Share your origin story.
Thank you so much, Mark. It has been a bit of a long and bumpy road to get where I am right now. I think when I was in high school, I was drawn to taking some of the technical courses. I enjoyed tech ed. I enjoyed woodworking. And I enjoyed a CAD drafting class. We were using AutoCAD release 12 at the time, so I'm dating myself, but you know, that's what we were learning on. And so I had a really good technology education teacher, Mr. Farrell. This was in Trumbull High School, Trumbull, Connecticut. And he encouraged me to look into something to do with architecture or engineering for college. And so I did research different schools. You know, this is one of those pivotal moments, right? When you decide where you're going to go to college. I made the decision to go to Roger Williams University early acceptance. It was the only school that I had applied to. I got in, I got an honor scholarship. So I was getting a free ride and I said, okay, done, one and done. And looking back on that, you know, I probably should have applied to a whole bunch of schools and done the whole song and dance, but I've learned a lot about my personality, and on the DISC profile, I'm a D, and I'm an ENTP, close to ENTJ when we talk about insight as to what motivates me. So I'm pretty much really extroverted, a go-getter, an action person. And once the item's checked off my list, I'm done, move on. So I picked a college, got in, got a ride, done. And that was rather pivotal because Roger Williams is a small liberal arts college in Rhode Island, rather secluded suburban campus, an interesting place to learn the subjective art of architecture, but not particularly at the time. The program has changed, but at the time it wasn't particularly focused on urban planning issues, larger picture things. So I'm glad I went to Roger Williams. It was a good program. At the time I did the 5-year BArch, and that's all I wanted to do was be an architect. I graduated, I enrolled in IDP. This is another funny story, and I don't know how much time we have for funny stories, but—
We love funny stories.
Again, when I enrolled in IDP, I did my homework and I found out that Texas at the time, allowed you to start taking the tests with only having 6 months of IDP under your belt. And I was like, oh, well, then I'll just take the Texas test because I don't want to wait for 3 years to have to take the Massachusetts test, which is where I was living at the time. So I ended up doing all of my Prometric exams in Massachusetts under Texas, getting licensed in Texas, and then getting reciprocity to Massachusetts right around the time I actually finished up my hours in Mass. It was 9 exams at the time. That's changed too, so I'm dating myself. But really, the moral of the story is, if you do your research, and it turns out I'm pretty good at doing my research, you can figure out a way to get something done that may be different than how everyone else around you is doing it. And maybe it's a better way. And I know we have an awful lot of architects who are creative thinkers who also think outside the box and do the same sort of, let me do my research. I bet you I can come up with a better answer. So I call that my architect brain for trying to think outside the box. Fast forward a couple of years, I had gotten licensed and I was working for a large AE firm in Cambridge, Mass, doing high schools. And I really enjoyed doing schools because it's a big project type. I like working with a large team. I like collaborating. It was really fun to have engineering in-house. So you could just walk over and sit with the structural engineer and resolve an issue immediately. All those things I think are really beneficial. And our project manager ended up having a heart attack. He didn't pass away, but he was out for a really long period of time. And so we divvied up all of the responsibilities on this project amongst the other members of the architecture team. And I got the contracts with the client. So I was managing, negotiating and signing a contract with the city of Quincy, Mass for a new public high school. And oh my goodness, I loved it. I was like, wow, how have I never had an opportunity to read and negotiate a contract before? This is cool. I like this. Can I do some more of this? So I ended up meeting with the vice president at the firm and saying, hey, I'm interested in learning more about contracts. And so, you know, we had some good conversations, but he actually encouraged me and said, if this is something you really want to do, maybe you might want to consider going to law school. So I took the LSAT and I applied to go to law school at night. Once again, I only applied to one school, Suffolk Law, Boston night program. And this was just when the recession was starting to happen, 2007, 2008, I began law school at night at Suffolk while I was still working for the AE firm. And then as the recession got more and more severe, we ended up cutting everybody's hours to pretty much half time, which is fine. I was going to law school at night and I had plenty of reading and writing to do outside of work. So I was busy. And then finally, I ended up getting laid off, which honestly, for those of you who've been there, sometimes it's a blessing in disguise because that allowed me to turn the page, right? I could move on with my life because of the layoff. That was the opportunity to really focus on some of the things that I enjoyed, which included consulting. So pretty much I jumped from being a director of BIM at a large firm and working on high schools as an architect to helping a whole bunch of firms all over Boston do Revit training support and implementation, content creation, and small training classes for their staffs. This is like 2010-ish. So it was a great time to be doing all of that stuff and also building my network, getting to know everybody in the game in the Boston area. And of course, going to law school at night. So that all worked out really well. And that's what my first introduction was to consulting, where you can kind of set your own hours, set your own terms, but still be able to make a difference. And gosh, I really enjoyed that a lot. But I was focused on the goal, finish up law schools to go work in a law firm. And I did. In 2012, I took my first job at a large Boston law firm that does construction, defect, and insurance claims. Some of you have probably heard of it. I'm not going to drop the name here, but it's well known. And this is a very large insurance defense firm that if you have insurance in the greater Boston area and there is a claim against your insurance, the insurance company can decide who defends the designer. And often they choose this firm. So I got to, once again, work with a lot of architecture firms in Boston, but on the insurance defense side. And that's where I learned that, man, construction law is really complex, really interesting, and hardly ever goes to trial because there are just too many nuances and you cannot really educate a jury about what's going on. So just expect if and when you get a claim in your life as a design professional, it will end up being mediated or arbitrated. It's not going to go in front of a jury. So you're not gonna have to educate a jury on how things work in the construction arena because it's just too complex. But that was an interesting 1 year of my life working for this large firm. I have to say, large firm culture at a law firm is kind of toxic. Everybody is trying to work crazy hours to get in their billable hours requirement. We had a 2100 hour billable hour requirement, which honestly means you're working evenings and weekends to try to hit that because not everything you do is billable. The alternative, of course, is you're not honest on your timesheets. I'm not one of those people, but there are lawyers who just, you know, do the biweekly lie to make it work. And it's a culture. So I decided that I really didn't want to stay in a law firm. I wanted to go out on my own because I was already an architect and now I'm a lawyer. And let's combine the two and start doing my own consulting as an architect attorney to help architects and also building owners and to some extent developers and folks who assist like CMs. And owners project managers. So that has really become kind of my thing to do since 2013. I like working in the industry and I like working with people, but I also get a little bored if I'm just doing one thing. So I still do architecture on the side. At the moment, I'm wrapping up a simple residential addition, probably about 1500 square feet garage with in-law apartment. And you know, it kind of keeps me connected and part of my roots. I'm still very engaged and involved with obviously having to do continuing ed each year for architecture and getting to talk to clients and kind of understand their motivation, right? Building owner clients as opposed to architect clients. I think I generally get their motivation too, but I try real hard to listen. So that brings us to where we are today. You mentioned that I'm pretty well-rounded and I have a lot going on in my life as architect, attorney, legislator, family farmer. I joined an organization called the Jefferson Society, right? Because that's basically what Thomas Jefferson was. It's a bunch of architect attorneys. And it was a really good networking opportunity. When we went to our swearing-in ceremony at the United States Supreme Court, I got to meet Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, which was a life-altering moment. She also made some major decisions that I think kind of put her on her path to where she ended up on the Supreme Court. And it was a humbling experience to see someone in her 80s still working and being passionate about making a difference. So I hope to be doing the same thing when I'm 80. But the Jefferson Society allowed me to meet a whole bunch of interesting folks who have the same kind of dual architect-attorney background. And so I met up with a woman who became my current business partner. Her name is Julia Donahoe. She is an architect attorney general contractor, and she's based out of California. So she's got sort of the construction and estimating side that I never really focused on. And I have the legislator policy side that she hasn't really focused on. So between the two of us, we actually bring a lot to the table. And so for the last 3 years or so, we've been working together as consultants. This is not our only thing that we do, but we have been helping homeowners whose houses burned down in California due to wildfires. And what we've discovered is that there is this systemic issue of insurance companies across California, all the big names, intentionally underinsuring homeowners and then not paying policy limits after a total loss. And so we've been able to put on our capes and fight for these homeowners to get the payout they need to rebuild their homes and get their lives back again. And that really is fulfilling for me to be able to make a difference. I'd like to be able to do that on a larger scale. So we're looking to ramp up the company and turn it into a tech firm. We could have a whole separate discussion about that specifically.
We can do that.
But, you know, going to tech from architecture is interesting. The players are all a lot younger than me and generally male. But, you know, when you're an architect, you can work with anyone. That has been a really fulfilling part of my life, being able to really make a difference for people who've lost their homes. And one of the things that we do as part of this group, Policyholder Pros LLP, is we provide contract review and consultation for homeowners and for architects, and in some instances, general contractors too, just to review the terms of the contract and do a legal review and then recommend what should be changed. And I find that a lot of our customers are repeat clients because they're serial builders and they're constantly doing construction and they get different contracts with different owners. So we're able to do the review. And that's very fulfilling too, because I feel like I'm helping people avoid the topic we're talking about today, which is what do you do when your project's going south? So I'll kick this back to you, Mark, but that's kind of my origin story and why I am and here I am.
Well, what a fascinating story. Thank you for sharing all that. And thank you for all of the service you're providing to so many different people in so many different areas, really making an impact in the world. Policyholder Pros, can you just, is that where, let me rephrase that question. If architects have their own contract that they're putting together that they want to use as an owner-architect agreement, is that something that you do as well? Do you work with architects to help prepare that document?
Okay. All the time. Yeah. We do custom contracts, and we also help with a post-mortem if we have a client who's dealing with a nasty situation and then we get through it. It's over. Thank goodness. Let's go back and revisit the contract and see where we can strengthen some of the parts that were perhaps under fire during that situation.
Let's make sure that never happens again.
You got it.
Very interesting. So policyholderpros.com is where architects can go to connect with you for that kind of work, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, yes. Great. Because I'm sure there's lots of architects right now writing that down. I want to make sure we're sending them in the right place. So let's have that conversation about what do you do when you have a project that doesn't go the way that you hoped, right? We all start our architecture projects very enthusiastic, very optimistic. Things are all going to go great. You know, the client loves you. You love the client. They love what you do. And so you want to get started. And so I'm going to throw it right back to you. What do we do at that moment, right? So, or maybe even prior to that moment, in order to make sure that later on if things don't go as planned, that we don't end up in a really bad position.
Absolutely. So let's talk about the two key elements that you always want to have whenever you're working on a project. The first is a contract. I know sometimes that's as simple as an email outlining the project description and the fee and maybe the schedule, you know, but that's still technically a contract. And when things go bad, you're going to turn back to hopefully a more formal contract than an email, but you're going to turn back to the project expectations, which are outlined in the contract, and figure out, am I really failing this client? Or is the client having unrealistic expectations? Or is there something that we haven't covered in the contract that's become a real sticking point between us? I mentioned schedule, maybe something that you may not have covered as well as previously or in other projects or just comparatively to other people. Sometimes schedule becomes a real sticking point in the contract because, let's be honest, when you first get a project and you're all hopeful that you'll be able to do the design and construction documents in 6 months, sounds reasonable at the time, especially if it's a smaller project. You're not that busy. Sure, okay, 6 months sounds good. So you may have said 6 months in your contract, but then obviously the owner's not responsive and it takes a long time to get their comments, and then things are dragging on and we're at 8 months and then they're angry because it hasn't been 6 months. So yeah, you may have said 6 months in the contract, but did you put something in there about the client has to also participate and be involved? And if they're not, then it's not on me, you know? So I'm just kind of giving an example of something that you may not have outlined in the initial contract, but contract is super important.
And that's second is insurance. And that, just for the contract part, before we jump into insurance, that's one of the reasons why that email agreement is not such a good idea, right? That we really should have prepared contracts that are written and have all the different.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, most firms that are just starting out will begin with something like an AIA short form contract, just at least to have the bare bones.
Yep.
And I do recommend AIA contracts because they're tried and proven in over 50 years of court cases. So we have a good sense of how a court would look at the contracts if it ever ended up at a court. And that's how the adjudicator or mediator will look at it, because it's history and precedent. But I really don't want to just say you have to have a contract that's a formal contract, because let's be honest, some of these projects are so small, you may have just written something on the back of an envelope and gotten the other party to sign it. But as you progress and grow as a professional, it is so important to have a standard form contract that you use for your projects, so you know and can add to it as you learn. There are certain things that you do and don't want to do with your clients. You know, one of the big sticking points is ownership of documents, right? And the AIA form kind of leaves it, you can check the box for multiple sections. Do you want to own it? Do you want the client to own it? Do you want to make sure they don't get to own it until they've paid you every dollar due under the contract? You have a couple different ways to choose how that's handled. And so customizing the contract for the way that you do work is really important. And we do recommend you have a standard contract. Absolutely. But I'm just kind of giving an example sometimes you're getting sued, or sometimes you're getting nasty emails and angry voicemails from a client, and you realize, oh crud, all I had was an email, right?
Right.
You can still use that email. Okay, don't get me wrong, but that's not the best practice.
The reason I bring that up is because I've had that happen. I've had that call from an attorney representing a client. And because I did have a written document, a written agreement, it very quickly went away. Because all I did is I pulled out the sections in the agreement and sent that to the attorney and said, look, this is what was agreed upon. And you know, once they realized that they didn't have much of a case, they went after somebody else, is what happened in my case, because it wasn't really our place that was the issue. It was somebody else. But we were just being pulled into that other mess.
Absolutely.
So okay, I don't want to get into contracts. I really want to talk,
talk more about contracts, but I just want to kind of give you a background that like there are certain things that are helpful in a contract. One of those, just to throw it out there, is a limitation of liability clause. You mentioned that in your situation, the owner decided to sue other parties.
Right.
Typically in a construction claim, the owner sues everyone.
Right.
You know, it's a leaky roof. They're going to sue everybody who touched the project. It's going to be the general contractor, the roofing sub, probably the framer, maybe the materials supplier, the architect, the engineer. Everybody gets sued. Okay. So if you have a limitation of liability clause in your contract that says the limitation of liability shall be limited to the total dollar value paid for the work, which is awesome, A plus, do that. But if you can't get that, at least limit it to your insurance coverage, which it, for most firms is somewhere between 1 and 2 million. You know, some very small firms is 500,000, but at least you're limiting it there. So if this turns out to be a doozy of a claim and the client is blanket suing everybody at the negotiation table, the lawyer who your insurance company has hired to represent you on the insurance claim will be able to point to the limitation of liability provision and say, well, the architect's only responsible for max 25,000 because that's what they got paid on this project. And oftentimes that's enough to just walk away and insurance will settle it for that. And, you know, yes, of course your premium will go up, but also it could have been so much worse. So limitation of liability is huge. If you don't have that, write that down, put that in your contract today. Cap it at the max project fee. I know some clients push back and say, well, you know, you're only going to pay me X. And what if the claim is so much bigger than that? And then if you have to negotiate it up to insurance limits, but you'd never want to go without a limitation of liability, at least to insurance limits. So that's kind of like contracts. Quick summary in a nutshell. Right. I could probably talk to you about all kinds of different parts of the contract, but there's some good takeaways here for nuggets. All right, insurance. So I've alluded to insurance several times. The reason you want insurance is so you can sleep at night. You get insurance for the what ifs. You don't really know what's going to happen. You don't know if this client that you're singing kumbaya with and you guys are best friends and you text each other at late hours just to check in, suddenly turns into the client from hell because you're not doing something that they expected you to do. So insurance is there to cover you when things go south. And an important note about insurance is when you get that angry phone call or that angry email or that lawyer letter, when you receive information that there may be a claim, you do need to forward that or give a call to your insurance carrier and let them know that you're concerned that one of your clients may be suing you. If you don't do that in a timely manner, if you don't do that in, say, 30 days from when you're put on notice, your insurance company may actually decline to represent you in the claim because you didn't let them know that something was evolving. Because the insurance company is trying to defend and help you. They want to get you a lawyer. They want to have somebody step in and cut this off at the pass. So do not stick your head in the sand. Do not set all of those nasty letters aside and ignore them. Definitely let your insurance carrier know that you've been put on notice of a claim. It's very important. That's the first step, and you don't want to lose out in the representation that you've been paying for in order to have your insurance. So do not avoid.
I can imagine.
No, lots of people do, but don't avoid.
Yeah, and I can imagine that is something that's sort of your first instinct is, I'm not telling my insurance company because my insurance is going to go up, right? Or you know.
But your insurance company is there to give you a lawyer to fight this.
Exactly.
And cut it off quickly.
Let's take a break to thank our sponsors for their support of this episode. As architecture demand increases toward pre-pandemic levels and beyond, how are you and your architecture firm keeping up? RCAT is here to help. RCAT.com offers several free tools to help architecture and design firms like yours get work done faster. Use RCAT's powerful search engine to find the right products for your projects and download BIM, CAD, and specifications right there on the same page, without needing to pay or register. It's free. RCAT.com also offers product videos, catalogs, green reports, product certification information, outline and short form specification generation, and so much more. Visit RCAT.com today. RCAT.com is your one-stop solution to help increase your productivity and get more projects done faster. That's RCAT.com. ARCAT.com. FreshBooks makes it simple to send invoices
post your expenses automatically, track your time for your whole team by project, and get organized with financial reports, communication, and notifications. My favorite feature in FreshBooks is the automated invoice reminders. I think sending invoices and getting paid is one of the biggest barriers to our success as entrepreneur architects. Who has the time? But if we don't send out the invoices, we don't get paid, right? FreshBooks makes it easy to send out your invoices and get paid fast, online, with a click of a button. And when your client doesn't pay you on time, FreshBooks will send them a friendly email reminder through a simple system that you control. Sign up for a free 30-day unrestricted trial and get ready for the simplest way to be more productive, organized, and most importantly, get paid faster. Go to entrearchitect.com/FreshBooks and enter Entree Architect in the How Did You Hear About Us section. That's entrearchitect.com/FreshBooks. Please visit our platform sponsors today and thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community.
So yeah, your insurance may go up, but also the risk of horrible, horrible things happening right. with the claim because you're avoiding it is way worse.
And the sooner they can address it, the sooner it can go away.
You got it.
And yeah. so the first,
and I have to say, this is a rite of passage. Okay. Some folks who have never had a lawyer letter sent to them or been on notice that there's litigation, there was a complaint filed, or that, you know, a whole bunch of folks on this project are all getting sued for poor performance. This is a rite of passage. Congratulations. You've been in business long enough to hit the point where there's a claim and you're involved in it. Like, hey, you know, you're now in grad school. Congratulations. You've made it to the big time. This is pretty normal. You know, most architects have 2, 3, 4 of these throughout their career. It's not huge unless you're doing malpractice or taking on a lot of condo clients, which is a whole separate session. We could have a discussion about what to do if your clients are condo developers or condo owners, because good gosh, there's a lot of claims there. But in general, it's not a big thing, but when it happens, just recognize that this is fairly normal and you've made it to the big leagues. And so be prepared to call your insurance company and to go back to the contract and see, okay, what did I promise? Because they're claiming I didn't do something that I'm pretty sure I did do in most cases. And just a note about that, about 90% of all construction claims are based on poor communication, and typically it's unmet expectations.
Right.
So to the extent that you can communicate well with your client and set expectations, create those guidelines and boundaries, including maybe not texting at 2 a.m. If you can set those expectations and be really clear with your client, then you are going to keep yourself in the clear from them suddenly saying, well, that's not what I was led to believe was going on. You know, you want to be super obvious. And this may sound like something that's basic, but just as simple as sending an email a week with a project update makes a huge difference for clients. Even if it's just a Monday morning, hey, just writing to check in and let you know that we're continuing to push the DD on your project. And that's all you send. Oh my goodness, that makes a huge difference for clients feeling like, oh, they're on it, it's under control, and I can write back with questions or whatever. The failure to do that, the fear, once again, sticking your head in the sand or being worried, oh, well, I was on vacation last week and I really need to work on all these things, but I'm not going to send an update until everything's perfect for the client. No, screw that. Just send an update of the current status to let your client know what's going on, because communication is more important than perfection. So really, do not avoid. This is your stop avoiding warning. You know, fire alarm went off. Stop avoiding. Stop everything. Send a nice little update to whatever client you've been avoiding talking to, just to let them know, here's what's going on. And you know what? It's not going to be as bad as you think. They'll reply back and you'll get some information and you'll move from there. But the alternative is you ignore the client, you avoid, it's been a month, suddenly the client's like, what's going on with my project? Oh my goodness, my architect, what? So don't go there. Don't create that situation.
Yeah, often the conflict stems from the lack of communication and not meeting an expectation, not necessarily a legal issue, right? The conflict may not have anything to do with the contract, right? That it has to do with a client thinking that something was going to happen and it didn't happen the way they thought it was going to happen. And so that communication and that management of expectation, which we've talked about so many times on this podcast, the management of expectation can help so many of these issues that we're talking about. That if the client knows what's coming and knows what's going to happen, which is why that written contract is so important, because then you have a document that you can manage that expectation through. Say, yep, right from the beginning, this is what you should expect from me. And then create those systems of constantly communicating with your clients so they're always knowing that they, well, at least thinking that they know what's happening and how it's going to happen.
That's great. So let's say that you've looked at your contract, contacted your insurance company. You definitely have a situation where you think the client's going to fire you. If they haven't already like said outright, I'm going to fire you. The next step in the process is you need to send them an invoice, right? Generally, in your contract, you're going to have terms that say that you're allowed to bill for everything up until the contract is terminated. So if it's been a month since you billed the client and you've been working away and you've got maybe 80 hours that you need to invoice, get that invoice out sooner rather than later. There may be lawyers getting involved. There may even be an outstanding sum. This might turn out to be a client who hasn't really been paying their bills timely. There could be 3 or 4 months of outstanding balances. Get out that final invoice with all of the costs on it to make it very clear that if this does turn into an actual financial claim, we can understand the amount of money at stake that hasn't been paid yet. And certainly, depending on your practice area, this could be tens of thousands of dollars at stake that you want to be super clear. This is the amount that needs to be paid as part of termination if you're really terminating the contract and getting rid of me and hiring another architect. So, make it black and white, get the invoice out.
All right. So first step, inform your insurance company. Second step, get that invoice out immediately.
And you'll want to look at your contract too, somewhere in there to figure out, am I at fault? What did I do? What's going on here? What are the rules of the game, right? If you were about to start a board game and you've never played it before, you read the instructions so you figure out how to play it. Well, your contract is exactly the same thing. It's the rules of the game. So obviously it's in your interest to write the rules in your favor as much as you can and get it signed by the other party. So when they're coming at you and saying, oh, well, you promised 6 months and it's been 8 months, you can say, well, it says right here that if the client is not timely with responding to requests, I have more time.
Right, okay. So that's really the first step. If somebody emails you or calls you and says, hey, you haven't done what you're supposed to do and I'm angry and I'm going to sue you, the first thing is you do is you make sure you understand your contract. Go back to your contract, review it, understand it, inform your insurance company, put together that final invoice, send them the final invoice. Then what do we do after that?
Then depending on how things are going, you may decide to quit the project. Or they may terminate you.
Yeah.
Or you may be able to negotiate and get things back together, right? So those are kind of the three big things. You quit, they quit, you figure it out, you find a path forward. I would probably say that for most clients, by the time they're getting lawyers involved and sending nasty legal letters and threatening to fire you, the best thing you can do is get out. It's very difficult to mend bridges and try to continue working with a client who gets that adversarial. So at that point, the communication has broken down so much, a divorce is probably recommended. Obviously you want to avoid getting to that point. So if you're seeing some warning shots, like it seems like your client's getting a little disgruntled, that's probably a good time to schedule an in-person or Zoom meeting to really talk things through and make sure that you can mend fences before you get to the point where they're threatening to fire you. Because at that point, they've already clicked in their brain, I want another architect.
Right.
And so trying to salvage it when it gets to really nasty, It's incredibly difficult, and you may not even want to work with them if you can salvage it, because the relationship is going to be strained for the duration of the project after that. So ideally, if you see warnings from your client that they're starting to get upset or feeling like you're not delivering or, you know, their expectations are not met, push everything aside, focus on that client, set up the meeting, have the discussion, talk about the hard things so you can save that project. Because, you know, this could be tens of thousands of dollars at stake that you worked really hard to continue and to produce and hopefully see a product at the end of it that has your name on it. So it is really important to do this sort of client handling. So let's just say you can't save it, right? Either you're going to quit or they're going to fire you. You know, six in one, half dozen in the other. Either way, you would look to the contract to see what the provision says about termination. Hopefully it says you get paid up until the actual date of termination so that your invoice covers all of your time for that. But more important, if it says something like 30 days notice in order to terminate, well, then you, if you've decided to get out, you need to do an email, a text message, something in writing to your client that says, please consider this my 30 days notice that I'm terminating the contract under the terms of the contract, or something like that, just to let the client know, hey, I'm out. This is your 30 days notice. I'll start getting all your documents together. I will give you, you know, the everything I have up until this point for your own personal use. If another architect wants to use it, we can have a podcast about that separately, but this is the product that you paid for, and this is the invoice for how much time I've spent, and I'm closing out this project. Be very clear with your client that you are terminating the contract. Or the opposite happens. They send you a nasty email and say, I'm all done with you. I want to be out. And so you look to the contract and make sure that they've met the criteria. If there was a 30-day notice for them to get out, you respond back and say, okay, I'll accept this as your 30-day notice, and we agree that we're terminating the contract. I'll send you an invoice shortly. You just want to communicate that you are a professional and that this is not necessarily personal. Oftentimes, this is just a business fallout. Business divorces happen all the time. So you just kind of say, okay, I recognize that you want out and I will send you an invoice shortly. And in 30 days from today, if it's September 1st and on October 1st, we're done with, you know, the project together, and good luck. So keep it professional.
Should that letter of termination be prepared with an attorney, or is that something that we can do on our own?
Oh gosh, you know, if you're an experienced professional and you've been communicating with clients for quite some time, you may feel comfortable doing this without an attorney. If this is your first time dealing with this and you're freaked out and you don't know if you're saying it right or doing it right, I do recommend talking to an attorney. I think that there are an awful lot of attorneys out there who kind of expect this sort of thing to always happen with an attorney. That's unrealistic. But in the same hand, if you're worried or nervous or concerned, absolutely call an attorney to help you just draft and submit something that meets the criteria that's been laid out in the contract. If you've been in business for quite some time, you may feel comfortable doing this yourself. I'm not going to say you have to hire an attorney, but if you feel like you need an attorney, get an attorney. You know, it's cheap money for an attorney that could save you a lot of money in the long term, just because having an attorney can help you get that last invoice, right? So an attorney is going to maybe charge you less than $5,000. For this portion of the game. But if you have like tens of thousands of dollars of invoices out there, it's well worth having an attorney make sure you get paid.
Yeah. Yeah. I've also found in my situation, which always I've had two situations, they were both cleared up very, very quickly. And most of it was because I did have the agreement, but then I also had a really good attorney who was good at sort of the conversation, right? We didn't have to go to a legal action. We just had some proper letters written and proper telephone calls, and the emotion and the stress that comes along with all this, especially if it's the first time, is not something we should ignore. And that attorney often will help you through that, right? Because you feel, okay, this person knows what they're doing. They're going to guide us through this process. And so the emotional part of it and the stressful part of it is reduced. It doesn't go away, obviously, but it certainly is a big piece of what you would pay for when you hire an attorney.
Absolutely. But once again, I'm not pitching you your lawyer for everything, but gosh, if you're losing sleep over this, you probably need to bring in somebody who's done this before.
Yeah. Okay. Is there anything after that? So we send that letter of termination.
Mm-hmm. So obviously you want to get paid, right? I'm going to keep harping on that because architects leave money on the table all the time. And I don't know why that is. Engineers don't really do that, and they end up with the same situations, but the engineers really push. And you are entitled to be paid the amount that you have worked for. Do not discount your last invoice. Do not feel like you need to slash some of your hours. You are entitled for every hour you've worked for. It's under the contract, and you need to keep submitting that invoice and keep pushing to get paid until you get paid. This is a big deal. Oftentimes that means you may need to file an action in small claims. Once again, many people self-represent in small claims. If you're not comfortable with that, you can find an attorney to file a small claim for you. You could go either way with that, but please make sure you get paid. And I'm going to harp on this a little bit because I think it actually speaks to the entire profession. I think that architects in general undervalue their work and don't go after that final payment. And clients have kind of learned that, especially clients who've worked with more than one architect. And so it becomes sort of an industry thing where like the architect will just leave that final invoice unpaid and move on without it. Don't do that. Don't create that reputation for the industry. That's really frustrating and disappointing to see that that's kind of the norm.
So in order to get that payment, is that just, we just follow up with more invoices, send collection letters? How do we get paid?
Yes. So you've got your initial final invoice that you're submitting as part of termination, whether you're terminating or they're terminating, right? Then you'll do a 30-day follow-up with another invoice saying it's been 30 days, you know, now it's becoming past due. You may do another invoice with a lawyer letter saying this work was performed under this contract, pay now or else there'll be action, right? You can also kind of draft that sort of letter without a lawyer if you're comfortable doing that, but you want to let the client know that you're serious. I did the work. We've done everything we needed to do to terminate the contract and pay me. And then obviously if they still haven't paid you, then we're getting into it's time to file a small claim. Unless right. They owe you an awful lot of money, in which case it may be a superior court claim. But either way, it's a claim for non-payment. And that does need to get filed as a next step. Oftentimes clients will actually test you to see how serious you are. They may ignore and ignore and ignore. And you actually need to involve a lawyer to get a response from the client, unfortunately. But, you know, we're talking about money that is due and owing to you. So it's worth going after. I know you may be really busy on lots of other projects, but this is your reputation and the industry's reputation on the line. So don't leave it on the table. I mean, obviously this is a business decision as well, right? If the outstanding sum is something silly like $1,500 and it's going to cost you more than that to go after it, you may decide to write it off. I'm talking about a pretty significant sum that's worth going after, right? So there's a difference. You may make a business decision not to go after a small sum that's not worth your time or paying an attorney to do. But nonetheless, you want to keep pushing to get paid. And if you can't get paid from this client who's either terminated or you terminated with them, you will need to go to court to get paid. Your contract should be bulletproof at this point. There shouldn't be any loopholes saying, oh, I don't need to pay the attorney I don't need to pay the architect if I fire them. It's never going to say that in your contract. Those are not the rules of the game. So when the judge looks at the contract, they'll say, hey, architect, did you do the work? Hey, owner, did the architect perform that work? You both say yes. And then the owner says, oh, yes, but then they quit. And the judge is going to say, yeah, but they performed the work, right? Okay, owner, pay that architect. Right. And that's really how it goes pretty much in these claims, because the contract is there to back you up. And it says, if I perform the work and I invoice, you pay me for it. Right. I mean, yes, it takes time, right? You may need to hire a lawyer. You may need to take some time off of work to go to court, but you also will get paid with small exceptions. You know, if suddenly the owner is going bankrupt, it gets really messy, but generally you will get paid and you need to push back and get paid.
So it all begins at where we started, all right, with a contract and the insurance. Because everything that you talked about, Rebecca, is that we need to go back to the contract, go back to the contract, go back to the contract. If you don't have a contract, then you don't have anything to go back to. You're going to be in a really difficult position. And so it starts with a contract. Make sure you have a good contract. Make sure you have insurance. And then go through these steps that we're talking about today. Is there anything, any other advice, any other steps that we should be talking about before we wrap things up?
We haven't said it explicitly, so I'm going to say it explicitly.
Yep.
Make sure the contract is signed by both parties. Mm-hmm. Okay. Having a contract and submitting the contract via email to the client as part of your initial intake is all well and good. Do not move forward with performing work until you have that signed contract. I know lots of firms will practice for a month or two waiting for the signed contract to come back. Don't do it. You will get too busy. You will forget. Simply respond via email to the client who says, oh yeah, can you come out and do some measurements so we can get going with this? You can say, yeah, as soon as you get me that signed contract, put it back on them. Do not start with work until it is signed. It is so important because you can't actually stand in front of the judge and say, this is the contract, unless the owners actually signed the contract and agreed to the terms. So super important. Do not pass go. Do not continue with the project until that contract is signed, even though it sounds like the best project in the world and you can't wait to get going and start invoicing. Signed contract. I think the last piece, once you've been through this sort of horrible situation with a crappy client that didn't work out for whatever reason, is to do that post-mortem.
Yes.
The lessons learned, to then take that piece that you've figured out that's really important for your own practice, the way that you work, and integrate that back into your firm contract. So you're ready again for the next client who tries to push that little button, and you've got a clause in your contract that protects you so that that won't be an issue in the future. And it is rather nuanced. Once again, AIA does a good job of covering generally blanket a lot of the issues that we've seen in the industry over the years, but it does sometimes help to have nuances that are specific to your firm. So for example, I have, a residential architect that I've done some contract updates for over the years. I've been working with him for about 15 years. And we have really zeroed in his residential client contract to exclude all kinds of things that you may not think about initially, like asbestos and any hot material or lead that might be in the house. He's not responsible for that. It's not his responsibility to find out about it. He's had issues with clients saying, well, my architect never told me that there was lead on the windowsills. Well, since when is it the architect's responsibility? So he's really clear in his contract, it's not my thing. And we may, in a historic property, need to have someone come out and test. It's not me. So creating those exclusions based on scenarios that have actually happened is helpful for the long term for your practice, just to be sure that that doesn't happen again.
Yeah, we have templates at the Entree Architect Academy, the membership, for a basic small firm architect, owner architect agreement that started as my agreement that I used for my own firm. And then we put together a course that basically just describes how that document's put together. And then we provide the templates with the instruction to take those templates to your insurance company, to your attorney, and customize them for your architecture firm. And so they have a lot of the clauses, a lot of the sections that we're talking about here today. Mm-hmm. And so that's another way that small firms could start. Take that document, then sort of customize it and craft it for your architecture firm. And so the steps, just to review before we wrap up. So make sure you have contract, make sure you have insurance. You have a problem, you get that letter, you get that email, make sure you check the contract, make sure you go through the contract, you understand it, read the whole thing, inform your insurance company, send out that invoice, right? Make sure it's a final invoice that has everything that you need to get paid for, everything that the contract says you are owed. Then you're going to go into that, you know, they're either going to fire you, they're either going to quit, or you're going to quit, or you're going to resolve this, because you potentially could resolve it with some conversations. We talked a lot about expectations management and communications. That's how you not get to this point, right? Make sure you're constantly managing your expectations, constantly communicating so you don't get that. If you do get the sense that there's somebody that's unhappy, fix the problem immediately. Don't ignore it, because then you will end up in this process. But if you do end up getting fired, or you decide you're going to quit, send that termination letter either with an attorney or put it together on your own, and then don't let the last payment go away. Get that payment, get paid, do what you need to do over and over and over again, get paid, and then do that post-mortem, go through the process, work through your contract, see what you can do to tighten it up, to make it a little bit stronger, to make sure if this ever happens again, you're covered, and it'll be a little bit easier process. Is that everything?
I think you've covered it beautifully, Mark. That's pretty much the bullet list.
All right. So before we wrap up, I want to ask you the one thing that we ask everybody here at Entree Architect Podcast. What is one thing that a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
Oh, now you're talking to the politician.
That's okay.
The most important thing any architect can do is building their network in their own community. Getting involved in your community is, in my opinion, whatever that involvement looks like. It could be being on the PTA. It could be being involved in your church. It could be running for politics. No, run for school board, run for selectman. Get involved, because in any community, let's just say the population of your town is 40,000 people, there's really only about 100 people who are actually making the big decisions and the movers and the shakers that are changing things in your community. So to the extent that you can be seen as one of those 100 people, that means you're at the top of the pyramid, you're networked, you're connected, you're dialed in, and other people will look to you and refer people to you for clients. So that's my recommendation. Get involved in your community, whatever that looks like. Become known and recognized for what you do, and then you'll start naturally getting word of mouth referrals.
Rebecca McWilliams is her name. You can check out her architecture firm at independentdesign.com. Check out policyholderpros.com, policyholderpros.com. That's where you can learn about all the legal services they provide. We'll have links to both of those websites on the show notes. Rebecca, thank you. This has been a super interesting conversation. I suspect that we'll probably do this again with some other legal topics, because there's so many different ways we could have taken this. I wanted to address this one specific issue, but I'm sure there's lots that we can talk about. So I'd love to have you come back. But thank you very much for joining us today and sharing your knowledge at Entree Architect Podcast.
Mark, it's been my pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me, and I look forward to a follow-up.
If you liked this episode of Entree Architect Podcast, please share a rating, write a review, and share a link to this episode with a friend. That's how Entree Architect Podcast will grow to serve thousands more architects just like you. Thanks to our sponsors, FreshBooks and RCAT, for their support of this episode. Links to our sponsors and all the resources we discussed today are available at the show notes for this episode, found at entrearchitect.com/podcast. Entree Architect is a member of the Gable Media Podcast Network. Gable Media is curated thought leadership for an audience dedicated to building a better world. Listen and subscribe to all the shows at gablemedia.com. That's gablemedia.com. And check out Entree Architect Academy membership. Ready to edit business resources, live monthly business training for architects, a supportive architect community, and Simple Systems, our business system program developed for you, the small firm architect. It's all waiting for you at Entree Architect Academy membership, including AIA Continuing Education Learning Units. Come join me and hundreds of your entrepreneur architect friends at entrearchitect.com/join. Enroll today at entrearchitect.com/join. Thanks for listening today. Love, learn, and share what you know.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and the sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure. And when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns. What's known in England is diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glenn Gary. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.
Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark Arlepage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short-haul frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.